Welcome back to the last half hour of Issues Etc. Today, I'm Todd Wilkin. Tomorrow on the program, a two-hour discussion on Christian Zionism with Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine. Why is it that it is standard kind of boilerplate, well, it's even a theological presupposition of much of American evangelicalism that if you're a Christian, you will support the modern state of Israel politically and in every other way. We'll find out why from Aaron Wolf of Chronicles Magazine tomorrow on the program in that two-hour discussion. In the last half hour of the program today, we're going to be talking about a fossil discovery of an alleged 27-million-year-old split-horned elephant in Africa. Apparently, the elephant ancestor that ruled Africa in its day. We'll find out when its day actually was and what the things that have been found actually do mean. Dr. David Menton is our guest. He's professor emeritus of anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis. He's speaker for Answers in Genesis and president of the Missouri Association for Creation. Dr. Menton, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Well, thank you, Todd. It's good to be here.
Let's just get the facts out. What precisely was found? What are the artifacts that we're being told are this elephant ancestor that ruled Africa?
Well, they certainly found a very large beast. He was about 7 foot tall, and he has the scientific name of Arsenoetheres, and the organism is believed to have lived in Africa 27 million years ago, and so that's the essence of this find, is that we have a very large animal that belongs to the order Proboscidae, which is the group of animals we call the elephants. Today we have two elephants still around from the Proboscidae, the African elephant and the Asian elephant, and these are smaller than, of course, the animal described in the report. But we do know that there were larger elephants in the past, elephants that had long hair, for example. Today, elephants do not have long hair. The woolly mammoth was certainly an elephant, belonged to the same order, had a trunk, had tusks, and it had very long hair. And the there were other, the mastodon was very much like the mammoth. It, too, is extinct. It differed primarily from the mammoth in having somewhat different kinds of teeth. So today we have about two elephants left out of all of the different sorts of elephants that once lived on the earth.
For the average person looking at the computer-generated picture of this creature set alongside a man for scale, they're going to say, as I first did, looks a lot like a split-horned rhinoceros.
Yeah, it does have the appearance of a rhino, and of course, all we have is, you know, some of the skeletal data, so we, you know, don't have enough, perhaps, to be completely certain how it relates to the elephants versus the rhinoceros, which is, belongs to a completely different order of animals.
So what is it we're actually looking at? Are we looking at a 27-million-year-old creature that, by the accounts or the speculations of some of your colleagues there at Washington University, was the dominant elephant creature in Africa at one time?
Well, of course, nobody was there. If indeed time were to go back that far, there would have been no human beings there to observe them, and we have to speculate based on what we think we know from fossil evidence, not having any of the soft parts of these creatures to look at. I question the dates, and I question the dates generally for fossils. There's a great deal of study going on in the last few years by creationists who have investigated rather deeply, some very sophisticated people, the mechanism by which we date things, particularly using radiometric dates. Now, when we hear dates like this, they're not always, it's not always explained to us, of course, how they came up with the date. Sometimes the dates, in fact, most often, the dates are really related on evolutionary assumptions of how long ago the animal lived and became extinct. And that's hardly a precise way to measure date. It's based on what we think we know about the time scale of the process of evolution, which is a process not known to exist itself. The more objective ways to date, of course, would be radiometric dating, if indeed all of our assumptions that go into these dates were valid. And that, I think, is really the issue. If you look at radiometric dating, it's sort of like looking at a hourglass. The sand flows from the upper chamber into the lower chamber. And if we are quite sure that the sand is flowing at a constant rate that has not increased or decreased, if we're quite sure that nobody has added sand in the upper chamber or taken it away from the lower chamber, we could then come up with an estimate of how much time has passed during which this hourglass has been operational. But these assumptions are not at all easy to come by when we look at radiometric dating. Here we have a product which is going through radiometric decay. It's unstable. That's why we call it radioactive. And it's decaying from what's called a parent product to what is called a daughter product. And that decay rate is believed to be constant, but we don't have really the independent way of determining whether that decay rate has been constant for most of the methods we use. There's a great deal of information which, if listeners are interested in some of the thinking going on these days on radiometric dating, particularly, I'd recommend two websites they might want to check out. One is icr.org. And that's the Institute for Creation Research, and it's there that an organization called the RATE Committee, R-A-T-E, which is an acronym, has been studying this whole matter. And if you get on the website, you'll see a great deal of information there that will get as simple or as sophisticated as you wish to get. Also, you can check the website answersingenesis.org. You run that all together as one word, Answers in Genesis, and then .org. And there, too, you can search for dating, age of the earth, elephants, whatever, and get a great deal of information off the Internet.
I wonder, on the dating subject, someone might say, well, look, can't we assume that, say, the rate of decay for these radioactive elements has been constant? Is there any reason to think that it hasn't been?
Well, that's an interesting question, and yes, there is very good reason to question whether the rate has been constant. The RATE Committee, whose work I described as being available on the websites mentioned, have looked at the most commonly used method, which is the potassium-argon, the uranium-thorium-lead method. And what they've done is to look at core samples that came from Mexico. They're very, very deep core samples in the earth, in which one finds crystals called zircons in granite. Now, the first thing you need to know is that these radiometric clocks involving potassium, argon, uranium, thorium, lead, or whatever, only work in igneous rock. So you can't date sedimentary rock by this means. And, of course, those are the very rocks that we find the fossils in. And when the molten igneous rock, like lava from a volcano, hardens or solidifies, that's when the clock presumably begins. And you get the countdown from the parent product to the daughter product. And if that rate could be assumed to be constant, if we could assume how much of the starting material we had to begin with, and if we're quite sure that the daughter material we're looking at today has not been added from or taken away, then we ought to have a clock. But when you look at these zircons, an interesting observation has been made. While the decay is going on, from starting with uranium and finally ending up with lead, during that decay process, helium is generated. Now, I think all of our listeners are familiar with helium, if less so with uranium and lead and some of these other substances we've been talking about. The decay process generates helium, and helium is very volatile. It doesn't form chemical compounds very easily, if at all. And it tends to escape. That's why helium balloons get smaller. When you blow them up, you come in the next morning and the helium is seeped right through the balloon. And so this helium would tend to escape from the zircons. And the thing that's surprising is we've known for several years now that there's vastly more helium still in these zircons than there ought to be, if indeed we are measuring ages, say, a billion or two years old. And the thing that's really intriguing is if you look at the rate at which helium is escaping today from these zircons, and you calculate backwards, how old would the zircon have to be to retain the amount of helium that it has, assuming that the present is the key to the past, it turns out it's about 6,000 years. If the process were much older than that, you should have much less helium still left.
Because the helium ought to be leaching out or leaking out of the system.
That's right. It's not chemically reactive, so it's not forming chemical, compounds. And there's good reason to know that it's leaking out of the system because there is other mineral that's outside of the zircon that has some of the helium in it that has leaked out, and it's at a lower concentration out there. So we know that it's flowing from inside out and not out in. And we can measure this rate at which the helium is lost from these zircons in which this uranium-lead decay process is ongoing. We can measure the rate at which the helium is lost, and if we use these assumptions, as indeed geologists do, to say that the present is the key to the past, that is, rates today are the same as they have always been, which, of course, we can't be sure of either. But it's very, very difficult to account for the levels of helium. For example, rocks contain about 50% of all the helium or over that would have been generated by the radiometric decay process. And there really ought not to be any helium. If you're looking at specimens that are, let's say, a billion years old, there ought to be no helium whatever, at least essentially no helium, in these crystals. And yet it's there, and it's not just there in trace amounts. It's there in very significant amounts. Now, the hotter the rock, in other words, the deeper they go in the core of the Earth, it gets hotter and hotter, you will get less and less helium as you go into the deeper rocks because heat drives the gas out faster. But in any event, that's just one of the lines of evidence to suggest that the process may have well been speeded up in the past and that the dates that we're getting are not that reliable. Further evidence that there's a problem is, for example, you can look at the lava that solidified from Mount St. Helens. That eruption occurred, what, in 1985?
Yeah, thereabouts.
Yeah, roughly 1985, pretty close. And so it hasn't been that many years, certainly not millions, right? And yet, if you look at the radiometric decay rates that have occurred or been observed, it would suggest vastly older time that the lava has been formed. And so we get all of these discrepant rates. And it's kind of interesting when radiometric methods are used to, date layers in the Earth. If the radiometric method does not agree with the evolutionary assumption of the age of fossils that are, let's say, found near these layers, then the radiometric method is discarded. Or they keep doing it until they get a date that's consistent with what they want. And one of the interesting things is that the data is so discordant. There's so many different dates that you can get that when you submit a specimen for dating to a laboratory by the potassium-argon or uranium-thorium-lead method, they want to know what geological formation that specimen came from. You fill out a form. And the reason they need to know that is they're going to get dates that are all over the place. And so they use the geological formation and the evolutionary assumptions regarding the age of that formation to choose what dates will be acceptable.
Now, that's very interesting, Dr. Menton. That's a little bit like you know, someone, you go to a so-called psychic and you say, read my mind, and he says, okay, tell me what you're thinking, and then I'll read your mind. Seems somewhat disingenuous.
That's right. It's sort of like up in Minnesota, my home state, you know, they always say that the American Indian knows how bad a winter it's going to be, and they finally had a roving reporter investigate how it is they knew this. And one of the Indians that was willing to divulge their secret said that it was easy. They simply watched how much wood the white man piles behind his house in the fall of the year. So you see, you've got a circular thing going here where the age of the rock is estimated by the presumed evolutionary age of the fossils it contains, and then they turn around and date the fossils by the age of the rock.
Now, one other thing I wanted to address in the few minutes that are left to us, Dr. Menten, and that is a concept raised by the St. Louis Post-Dispatch story on the elephant ancestor that once ruled Africa, and that is parallel evolution. I remember as a kid when we were kind of being simply taught what evolution was, you had your single-celled organism, and then from that branching out like a bush or a tree, all other organisms kind of sprung up from there. There were no dead ends. There were no parallel developments. Now I take it that parallel evolution is kind of standard evolutionary teaching. In fact, one of the paleontologists, I think, in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch calls this creature that they have found an independent evolution experiment.
Yes, kind of on a sidetrack by itself.
What is this about?
Well, you know, when we look in the fossil record, we find lots of animals that don't exist today, and I would say this particular creature is simply an example of an animal that has become extinct. Extinction we're quite aware of. In fact, it's been estimated that if you look at microorganisms, there may be over 100 extinction of species per day. So that everybody agrees animals are becoming extinct, what we don't see is the simultaneous production of new animals, right? I mean, how many new animals have popped into existence to take the place of all of the animals that we know are becoming extinct and have become extinct? And so that's one area where creationists and evolutionists agree, and that's in the area of extinction. And I would say that the creature they found is merely an extinct animal. He, as you say, looks more like a rhino than he does an elephant. Whether he's related to the elephants or not, I have no way of knowing, and I doubt they do either. But the point is that it isn't an extinct creature. And did it evolve into something else? I mean, how would we know? It's been said, and this is something that's very sobering, that there's not a single fossil that has ever been found that can be declared to be the known ancestor of any other living creature. Declared with confidence. We can speculate, but how would we know that a particular fossil seen in the fossil record gave birth or ultimately produced in time some fundamentally different organism?
So why would it be in the interest of the paleontologist to classify this as an elephant ancestor rather than what they depicted as being looking like, at least, I mean, from the layperson's perspective, a rhino ancestor, for that matter, the ancestor of my dog?
Yeah, I would have to look at, I've not seen the original paper, which, as I understand, occurred in Nature, and I haven't looked at the current issue to really see, you know, what the what it is. There are certain anatomical features that are associated with the proboscidae, or the elephants, versus, you know, the rhinos. And it may be that they have other evidence to suggest it's more similar to one than the other. But be that as it may, I mean, let's just look at the elephants that exist today. We have the African elephant and the Asian elephant, which are not only two different species, they're two different genera, okay? So the next level up in classification, like we are Homo sapiens, well, they are different at both the species and the genus level from one another in terms of the way they're classified. And yet an Asian elephant and an African elephant can interbreed and can produce viable offspring, although these elephants don't normally live very long. They do, in fact, produce viable offspring.
So there may be a problem with the classification?
Yeah, I would say the African elephant and the Asian elephant represent one created kind that God had created. And I would assume that since the mastodon is believed to be more closely related to the Asian elephant than the African elephant, that if mastodons were alive today, they would interbreed with elephants as well. Now, they would have some genetic uniqueness about them. For example, nobody has succeeded in producing a living elephant with long hair like a woolly mammoth had. You can raise these elephants in cold climates. They don't get long hair. I mean, that is a gene pool that apparently has been lost. But I certainly suspect that if mammoths and mastodons were around today, that they would interbreed with both African and Asian elephants. In fact, in Nepal, there's a videotape that circulated around some of the channels dealing or TV channels dealing with nature of elephants in Nepal that have characteristics of the mastodon, that kind of a hump in the back and what have you. And so there have been reports of basically mammoths and what have you, even going back to like ancient Rome. We have Mastodon State Park, which is right near us here outside of St. Louis. And there they found a mastodon that had a Clovis spear point embedded in the bones of the mastodon skeleton. And this was the first evidence, from science at least, that mastodons and modern man live together.
Dr. David Menton, it's always a pleasure and very interesting to speak with you. Thank you very much for joining us on Issues Etc.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Menton is Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Washington University in St. Louis. He's a speaker for Answers in Genesis and President of the Missouri Association for Creation. If you'd like to check out their website, the Missouri Association for Creation, it is gennet.org. That's gennet.org. There were two other websites that Dr. Menton gave us. One, if you want to go and look into the dating issue or into issues like this a little more deeply, one was the website for the Institute for Creation Research, ICR.org, and the website for Answers in Genesis, which is simply Answers in Genesis, all one word, .org. Tomorrow on the program, Christian Zionism. Why is it that Christians, many Christians, believe if you're a real Christian, you'll support the modern state of Israel, come what may? Aaron Wolf will answer that question for us. He's from Chronicles Magazine tomorrow on the program. It's a two-hour discussion. Then, Sunday night on Issues Etc., the author of our Issues Etc. book of the month for December, St. Nicholas, the real story of the Christmas legend. We'll talk about St. Nicholas live Sunday night from 10 to 11 on 91.5 FM here in St. Louis.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.